Tzoharaim Tovim. Lovely to see everybody here. What we're going to do today is we're going to try and learn a chapter of Tanakh together and study a story about Elisha and Naaman. Naaman is the army general of the Syrian army, of the army of Aram. Aram, which was a very important kingdom in the Middle East, and an aggressor in this period, the period of Elisha, the major aggressor against Israel, who really caused huge havoc in the northern kingdom. Aram with the capital of Damascus, things haven't changed in that regard. Naaman is the Ramatkal, the head of the army, the chief of staff, and he happens to be a leper, a Metzora. Maybe let me add by way of introduction before we even start studying the story, and I'm going to give you 5 minutes just to, or 5 or 6 minutes just to read the story, b'chavruta, with the person next to you so you can familiarize yourself before we analyze it. But I just want to, some people ask me why you've chosen to teach this story. Reason number one is because I'm writing about Malachim Bet. At the moment, I produced a book on Malachim Aleph, and Be'ezrat Hashem, by the end of Pesach, I hope I will have finished the manuscript for the Malachim Bet book. So it's nice to teach things, and it helps people's comments. You know, who knows? I had one shiur which I gave recently, and somebody gave a comment. I said, that was really good. And they said, will you put that in a footnote? So, yes, I hope that many of your insights will make it to footnotes or to the text of the book. One of the reasons why there are two reasons why I love teaching the story. One, I'm teaching this week. This is a haftarah for Parshat Tazria, but it's a very, very poor haftarah because it never gets read. Usually Tazria and Metzora are put together and we read the haftarah for Metzora, and the poor haftarah of Tazria never gets read. And even in a year like this year, where we should be reading Haftarah of Tazria because they're separated, it's Parshat HaChodesh, right? We end up reading this about once every 8 years. Now you could say, okay, why are you feeling so sorry for poor Naaman? But after all, he's our enemy's army general. But the real secret is that there are certain things which go back to our, we just had a session about psychology and, you know, childhood experiences. So when I was a little boy, I don't know how old, 6, 7, 8, we had some children's books at home. And they were in England. Anybody from England knows the Ladybird books. They were children's books. And one of them was called Naaman and the Little Maid. And it was this, I used to love this story about Naaman and the Little Maid, because usually it was about, I don't know, whatever nursery rhymes. But this one was actually about a Jewish story. I had no clue it was in Tanakh. And many years later, I read this story in the Tanakh. I thought, wow, that reminds me of what I read when I was 7 years old. And because I had this story by my bed, and I actually used to read it quite, I used to like it. It was really good. You know, the Navi comes out on top. I don't know, I have this very childhood relationship with this book. And I simply say, you should be careful what stories you buy for your children and grandchildren. If you can somehow endear Bible stories to them at a younger age, it might really affect their love of their Judaism and Tanakh, which goes way into adulthood. And we should be aware of that effect that we have. Early childhood reading really is quite powerful. So this is where we build up our relationships. What I would like to do is give, I think it'll just be easier. I think it's good to have read the entire story and familiarize ourselves before we start analyzing it. So what I would like to suggest is a great way to study is to study b'chavruta. Just sit and read aloud with the person who is in proximity to you. And what I'd like to suggest is that I've divided the text somewhat into paragraphs. Read through a paragraph. We're going to take about 10 minutes to do this. Read a paragraph, and then just ask yourself, maybe ask your chavruta, any comments, any observations. Maybe there's something strange about the paragraph, and see if you can reflect a little bit on the paragraph, and then move on to the next one. And we'll take, you know, I think it'll take 8-10 minutes to read through the story, and then hopefully we'll sit and analyze it together. Okay? Yes, I have one sheet. Are there any more sheets? Well, maybe you can share one between two. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. I know that not everybody's finished, but I'm a little worried about our time. So I'm going to, I think people have hopefully read enough at this stage. Even if you haven't got to the end of the story, hopefully we will collectively do the end of the story. We have a sense of what's going on in the story. I'm already, before I start, I'm going to say that much of my analysis comes from a book by Professor Yair Zakovich, Professor Emeritus of Hebrew University. He is not a Chovesh Kippah, or as we say, who Chovesh Kippah Tashamayim. He wrote an unbelievable book, 150-page book, just on this chapter, called Gavoa Me'al Gavoa. And I think his analysis is really fabulous, and I'm going to share with you some of the insights. I'll add a few insights of my own, but quite a bit of the analysis is his. And we know that Chazal say that whoever says Davar b'shem omro mevi geula leolam, that we should say where we get things from. So I'm trying to bring geula leolam. Let's begin with the first verse, the first pasuk. And in the first pasuk, as Tanakh frequently does, it gives us a introduction to the personalities. You know, sometimes you have a very, very brief introduction to personalities. Sometimes you have a more lengthy introduction. Sometimes personalities are not introduced whatsoever. You know, we're all familiar with, Eile Toldot Noach. Noach ish sadik tamid haya bedorotav. Noach was a righteous man in his generation. You know, frames the personality. And then, so how do we frame this personality of Naaman, who's this dominant army general? And if you look at this opening pasuk, which tells us who this man is, we will see maybe what we're going to see is the key to the entire chapter, where it introduces a certain, let's call it literary technique, and certain words which I think are going to become very, very pivotal in the chapter. Zakovich points out that the beginning, actually, the opening sentence, what in academic circles they call the exposition, or in Hebrew the meitzag, can fit into four different phrases. And we'll see in a minute, each phrase is double-barreled. Let's read it and understand what I'm talking about. V'na'aman tsar tzava melech Aram. The first detail, Na'aman is the officer, the chief of staff of the king of Aram. Haya ish gadol lifnei Adonav. He is a great man before his master. Onesu panim, and he is, a man of repute. Ki bo natan Hashem tshua la'aram, because God has given him victory. He is a supreme army general. Va'ish haya gibor chayil mitzora, and he is a gibor chayil, a man of valor, a man of fighting, a mitzora. Now, even if we start with the last phrase, ha'ish haya gibor chayil mitzora, how would you translate that? He is a mighty man of valor. So we could say, and he is a leper, but we might want to say, but. But he's a leper. In other words, this is an essential problem. Now, Zakovich wants to claim that really, in each of these four sub-phrases, each of them are divided into two clauses, where each one, you have the introduction, which gives his praise, but then there is always a qualifier. There's always a but. Let's go again from the beginning and explain what I mean. Naaman Sartava. He is a army officer. But, like maybe Nimrod, right? Is it his army? It is the army of Melech Aram. So he's Sartava, but it's the army of Melech Aram. In other words, he's an army officer, but it's not his army, right? It's the king of Aram. Haya ish gadol. He is a great man, okay? But, lifnei Adonav. And again, here I want you to pay attention to the word lifnei, which is going to be a very key word. And we might say here that lifnei means subservient to, right? Not just before, but before in the sense that he is lifnei Adonav. He is a great man, but it's... But he himself, he might be great, big, and we'll see this phrase, ish gadol, pay attention to this as well. But he is lifnei Adonav, he is subservient to his master. Onesu panim, we haven't got time to examine where this appears elsewhere in Tanakh, but let's say he is a man of high society or of great repute. But why? Ki bo natan Hashem tshuah l'aram. Is it his victories? No, it's really Hashem's victories. Va'ishaya gibor chayel, and he is a mighty warrior, right? However, he is a metzora. What you're seeing in the opening lines is this very interesting sense where this man seems to be at the top of the echelons of his country. He is one of the most important societal figures. He's the head a military figure. And yet, the text here in the introduction keeps on punching him down, keeps on saying, yeah, he's good, but, right, he himself is involved in a certain, he is limited, right? And one of the things, this phrase of, which I mentioned, lifnei, and maybe I'll mention another phrase here, adonav, these words, lifnei and adon, are going to recur throughout the chapter over and over and over. And here I want to emphasize that we're going to be dealing very much with hierarchical societal power structures. That part of what underlies this chapter is an attention in between the lines, in between the narrative, that society is very strongly layered, and there are people who are higher and there are people who are lower. There are the upper classes, the lower classes. There is a subordination of power. There are people who command you. And that is, you know, how things work. Let's take this forward a little bit to illustrate it in the upcoming Psukim. V'aram yatsu gududim, this is, by the way, a period where Aram starts going out in raiding parties, right? Which is essentially what happens. It says in the English here, once the Arameans were out raiding, right? There are raiding parties. In the next chapter, by the way, we see them attacking more severely and more severely until in chapter 6 and 7, they actually engage in a siege against the capital city, Shomron. So this is the beginning of an escalation of military conflict, where here we're just dealing with border raids, you know, across the border. Yes, sir? Okay, so we, I understand, and I think it will be complementary, and we'll see it in it. We'll see it as we go forward. Okay, so v'aram yatzu gududim, they go out in raiding parties. V'yishbu me'eretz Yisrael, they captured from the land of Israel. Which, by the way, this phrase Eretz Yisrael, it's one of the few places in Tanakh. Usually, Eretz Yisrael is called Eretz Kana'an. I think there are about three places in the whole of Tanakh where you have this combination. Eretz Yisrael, this is one of them. Very interesting. They take from Eretz Yisrael na'arak tana. Vatihi lifnei eshen aman. Okay, now, anybody want to tell me what you see here? So there's the lifnei, right? She serves eshen aman. Okay, now again, I think I want to see a double subordination here. Okay, first of all, this na'ara katana is never going to be named. Okay, which is just a na'ara katana, but she is lifnei eshen aman. Okay, so she is first of all subordinate to Naaman's wife. But even that phrase, Eshet Naaman, even Naaman's wife doesn't have a name, right? You know, in other words, she is subordinate to the wife of Naaman, right? In other words, we're building up hierarchies here. Anybody else want to comment on something I haven't commented on?
Well, she's a Na'ara Katana, as opposed to just a Na'ara. So I would think that would even, in terms of what she does next, in terms of advising him what to do,
okay, so first of all, she's a Na'ara. She's not just a Na'ara, she's a Na'ara Katana. So we wouldn't expect her to come up with a key suggestion. It's very interesting that the suggestions, the good suggestion here is going to come from the lowest stratum of society, from the person who's at the bottom of the totem pole, right? Anywhere else where that happens in the story? Where the suggestion comes from the lowest stratum of the totem pole? The servants, later on in the story, when Naaman doesn't want to go into the river, it's the servants who come up with the big suggestion. They're the ones who convince him to do it. So it's fascinating that it's sometimes you think that the big honcho, right, is going to make the decision, but actually in this case, it's the little people. Now, think about that phrase, na'arak tana, where we see a phrase which plays off with that. The opposite of katan? Gadol. Help me? Ish gadol, right? You've got the ish gadol, right? But maybe this is accentuated by the fact that he has this na'ara katana. He's the top of the totem pole. He actually isn't the top of the totem pole. His king is, okay? But then we have the na'ara katana, who's emphasized, she's precisely the opposite of this. And if I'm already there, I'm going to jump forward. And anybody remember what happens to Naaman after he goes into the River Jordan? He's cleansed. And? Right. So if you look at how it goes, take a look at Pasuk Yud Dalet, okay? And just here it says, it becomes like a little boy. Look in the Hebrew, okay? That his skin, vayashav basaro, his skin returns. And again, it's interesting, he returns. Kibsar na'ar katon. In other words, he might be the ish gadol, the opposite of ish gadol. Opposite of ish, I guess, is na'ar katon. Gadol katan. There's going to be an interesting process whereby, and this maybe goes to what you were saying, that the ish gadol has to become a na'ar katan. Okay, and here we get the na'ara katana. Who's taken, and he's ripped away. He's taken her captive by Ishbu. He's taken her against her will, using all his powers, and she's taken her as his servant in his house. Not even his servant, his wife's servant, right? She's right at the bottom. But it's going to be a fascinating thing where he's not going to be clean until he himself becomes a nar katon. Okay, so I'm already introducing these layers of hierarchy, which I think go to the key of the story. Go to the heart of this story. And if we keep reading, right? So we've already seen this hierarchy in Pasuk Bet. So let's read in Pasuk Gimel. Vatomer, and you'll notice all the key language is very hierarchical. Vatomer el gvirta, right? Not Vatomer el eshet na'aman. She says to her mistress, Chalei Adoni, lifnei Adoni. So again, my master should go and appeal to the Navi Asher b'Shomron. Az ye'esof oto mitzarato. He will heal her from his sarat. We wonder. Does she know Elisha's name? Maybe she's just heard stories about Elisha, right? People told stories about Elisha. We actually know that because later on in Perek Chet of Malachim Bet, the king one day comes and finds Gehazi and he says, I guess the king was feeling a little depressed, and he says, oh, tell me a few good Elisha stories, a few tzaddik stories. I need to hear a good maiselach of the Baal Shem Tov, right? Of Elisha. And he starts telling about how Elisha revived a child from death. If people told Elisha stories, and it seems like even up there on the northern border, you know, in one of the little yeshuvim up on the Lebanese border, the Syrian border in the edge of the Golan, people are telling, she knows there is a Navi in Shomron, she trusts him. Go and you'll be healed by him. And now look again, the language of Adon. Vayavo vayaged la'adonav. Here, by the way, it skips a layer, but notice she says to her mistress, my master should go and appeal to the Navi in Shomron. And then clearly the mistress tells her husband, and then he goes, who goes? Naaman goes, la'adonav, to his master, and says, Kazot, Kazot, Dibran Anaram Asheret Israel. And Melech Aram says, you know, go and I'm going to send a letter to Melech Israel. And go and take all of this money and all of this changes of clothing, and we're going to get this done. You're going to have to excuse me because I need to make headway. So please excuse me if I don't take questions at this stage. Let's take a look at the scene. We're going to just read quickly Pasuk Vav through to Vav and Zayin. Vayavo ha-sefer, so he sends a letter to Melech Yisrael. Vayavo ha-sefer el Melech Yisrael neymor, va'ata kavo ha-sefer hazeh elecha. When this letter comes to you, hinei shalachti elecha Naaman avdi, I'm sending you Naaman, my servant, and you're going to cure him from his sara'at. Vayiki kro Melech Yisrael et ha-sefer. And when he read the book, Vayikra Begadav, lovely Lashon Nofela Lashon, Kikro, Kikroa, the reading and the ripping, right, seem to be resonant. It's a sort of, you know, they're playing with the sounds. Vayikikro Melech Yisrael at HaSefer, when he read the book, the letter, Vayikra Begadav, he tears his clothes, Vayome Elohim Ani Lahamitu Lachayot, Am I God to make to cause death or life? Ki zesherach alai la'sofish mitzaratok yachta urna urna ki metanehuli. He's playing around with me. Why does the king have such a crisis? Tears his clothes. This is a terrible moment. We're in crisis. What's his problem? What would you expect him to do? What should he maybe do?
He thinks it's a setup.
A setup. Why a setup? Okay, so basically, you're giving me an offer, you know, I can't refuse, but really an offer I cannot fulfill, right? You're basically telling me I'm sending my servant Naaman, who happens to be the chief of staff, right? I'm sending my chief of staff and you're going to cure him from his sarat. Now the king knows that that's impossible, right? And basically you're going to cure him. So basically if you don't cure him, what's the assumption? It's war. So basically this is like, maybe the king of Aram fancied a little bit of amusement, right? He thought, let me think of a creative way to declare war, right? So this is what he's doing. He was bored that morning. He didn't fancy just saying, we're declaring war against you. So he thought of a more entertaining way to do it. And the king of Israel tears his clothes because he realizes, basically, Ha'elohim ani lahamitu l'achayot, right? Now, okay, what do you think he should have done? What could he have done instead of tearing his clothes? Call Elisha, pick up the bat phone, right? Call Elisha, right? I mean, he doesn't know what the Nara Ketana knows, right? Elisha's there. So I actually think that the Nara Ketana is quite sure. Call Elisha. Elisha lives in Shomron. He's right there. What's the problem? Here, I think, is actually one of the most amazing things about this chapter. Why doesn't he call Elisha? I would like to maybe take one step back. One of the interesting questions, we've been speaking about hierarchical relationships in this chapter. When you look in Pasuk Vav in verse 6, it says, he brought the letter to the king of Israel, and he says, now when this letter reaches you, all the commentaries ask the question, is this the whole letter? Or does it say before, did the king of Aram, you think he's asking for a big favor, he might say, oh, king of Israel, you mighty and wonderful king, may all the power rest at your feet. Please, if I find favor in your, you know, were there any honorific introductions before this, or is this the whole letter? And one thing that's just fascinating is if you look later on in Malachim Bet, Perek Yud, we actually see a letter from a Yehu, who is a very violent king, a king who's just taken over the kingdom through great violence, and he writes to the officers of Shomron in exactly the same phrase, Va'ata kuvo ha-sefer hazeh, when this letter comes to you. And Zakovich points out that this is a typical letter from a senior, somebody who is senior, from a king to a vassal, or from somebody who is in charge to a subordinate. In other words, the king of Aram looks at Melech Yisrael as being subordinate to him. You're under my thumb. You will do what I say. Now, again, there seems to be something wrong because the king thinks he's asking for something impossible. And here I think there's an amazing set of lines being crossed here. In the entire ancient Near East, and we see this from many stories, who did the prophets work for? The prophets were employed by the kings.
But kings of Israel always had a very difficult relationship with the prophets.
Exactly. Aram assumes that the king of Israel's court is somewhat like his. I don't know how intimately he knew it. And he therefore assumes that who controls the prophet? The king. The king pays his salary, right? There's a wonderful scene in the book of Amos, chapter 7, where Amos gives a prophecy and he says the king's going to die and he's going to be killed by the sword and the nation's going to go into exile. And the high priest comes and taps him on the shoulder and says, you can't talk like this in this temple. And Amos turns around to him and says, Lo navi anochi velo ben navi anochi, right? I'm not one of those types of prophets where my father was a prophet and my father before him. In other words, I'm not on your payroll. The prophets on your payroll say whatever you want, right? But I'm a real prophet. And whatever God tells me, I say, and therefore I'm not under your thumb. I'm an independent agent. You can't control me, right? And I'll do whatever I want. You see other scenes in, you know, Achav, the king Ahab, has 400 prophets who dance to his tune, and whatever, as they're being ushered in, they get given their lines, right? Whatever you're going to say. In other words, HaMelech Aram assumes, he got told by the Na'araktana, there is a prophet in Israel. How do you get to the prophets? Ask the king. The king is controlling the prophets, except in Israel, like you said. In Israel, we all know that the prophets are non-hierarchical, right? The prophets are loose cannons. The prophet is the one who can turn around to the king and tell him he's going to die. The prophet is going to berate the king, right? In other words, the prophet upends the entire hierarchy. The prophet is an independent player. So here's the irony. The king of Aram thought that to get to the prophet in Shomron, he has to appeal to the king of Israel. The king of Israel never imagined that he could ask anything of the prophets. He never even entertained in his wildest dreams that he could tell Elisha to heal this man. So he says, I can't do anything. And you're saying, pick up the bat phone, call the Navi. He says, I can't tell the Navi what to do. The Navi decides. The Navi tells me off. I don't tell the Navi what to do. So we have this unbelievable, very beautiful mismatch, which shows that the Navi is not working for the king. The Navi is working for himself, or as we will see in a few minutes, the Navi is working for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, so this is like the amazing tension, the way that this story develops. Let's take it forward a little bit. And let's look in Pasuk Tet, okay? When Naaman comes, and notice the sense of grandeur. Naaman comes, besusav uvrichbo, v'yamod petach habayit le'elisha. Naaman comes with his whole motorcade, right? With his whole entourage, and stands at the entrance of Elisha's house. V'yishlach elav Elisha malach. Elisha sends a messenger saying, go and bathe in the Yarden 7 times and your skin will be returned to you and you'll be purified, you'll be healed. And now, Naaman's reaction, right? Naaman gets, Vayiktsof Naaman. Naaman gets angry. Vayelech vayomar hinei amarti elai yetze yatso. I said, elai yetze, to me, he will come out. Even that phrase, yetze yatso, indicates he will come out in a procession, in a honorific procession. Va'amad, and he will stand. V'kara b'shem Hashem Elohav. He will call in God's name. Ve'inif yado al ha'makom v'asaf ha'mesorah. He will wave his hands over the infected area of my skin, and I will be healed. Halo tov amanau parparna rok damesit mikol me Israel. I need this dirty little Jordan River. We've got much better rivers back home. Hallo erchatz bahem v'taharti. He's probably already tried, right? I can bathe in those rivers if I want to be healed. A river's a river. V'yifen v'yelech b'chema. What do we notice here? Tell me, what do you observe here? Or what do we say about Naaman?
He was insulted.
He was insulted. He certainly was insulted. Where? How do we see that? So first of all, very interesting. He doesn't go and knock on the door or ring the doorbell, right? He stands, petach habayit, and expects the prophet to come out to him because I'm the important one, right? In other words, who's important here? Who's in command? He's assuming, once again, just like the Melech Aram thinks that Melech Israel controls the prophet, he will also control the prophet. I'm the important one. Eilai yetzeh, so it's all about me, right? That's one of the things. What else do you notice?
He's got a hair trigger.
What do you mean?
He doesn't take anything before he immediately concludes this is just nonsense. I'm being insulted.
He's very short-tempered. Notice his statement in verse 11 and 12 begins with Vayiktsof, right? Lovely phrase, ketzef, right? Anger. Also means foam. He's foaming at the mouth, right? Vayiktsof, right? Vayichar af, by the way, right, is the flaring of the nose. Vayiktsof is foaming at the mouth. I don't know what's worse, right? But these are very interesting phrases. He gets angry, and then the end phrase is Vayifen Vayelech Bechema, right? We just read read about Haman, right? He's a very angry man. Now, why do people get that angry? When they feel insulted, their dignity is insulted. You can hear that. Eli Yetzei Yatzor. So he's full of his own dignity, and he's quick to anger. Yes. Ah, he didn't like being told what to do by the servant, you think? Oh, that's interesting. The lady at the back, yes. Exactly. He didn't think he'd have to do anything, right? And this is something which I think goes to the heart of the pagan mindsets. I put on the back a source from Rav Hirsch. It's a very succinct, short text, but I do think it really goes to the heart of a very big difference between Judaism and the pagan world. Source number one at the bottom here. Rav Hirsch says, Judaism and paganism go in diametrically opposed directions. The pagan brings his sacrifice in an attempt to make the god subservient to his wishes. In the pagan world, you have certain formulae in order to, you appease the gods, you feed the gods. Your aim is the god should do what you want, right? The Jew with his offering, and this is the word korban, that we come near to God, wishes to place himself in the service of God. By his offering, he wishes to make himself subservient to the wishes of his God. We don't expect, because we do the right formula, God to listen to us. We expect that we do our avodat Hashem, and what will be, right? But we don't necessarily, our aim is not to ensure a certain outcome or assure a certain outcome.
To manipulate God.
So you're saying he's feeling a sense of resentment because he's already an outcast. It's a societal stain. Exactly. He has to, although I assume his servants could put up a little hut or something like that. But yes, I do think that's definitely true. He expected a ceremony, a dignified ceremony. Right? He's going to do some mumbo jumbo, some hocus pocus, and that's what he's going to do. And suddenly he's being asked to do something. And it's something that he thinks that he's tried before. He thinks he knows. He doesn't think it can help. And now, of course, who comes up with a solution? His servants, right? Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayikshu Abadav, they approach him and they speak to him and they say, notice by the way how tentatively, Vayikshu, Vayadabru, Vayomru. They're nervous to speak to him. They have to go in sensitively. You know, they go in and they wait. You know, there are three phrases here. And they say, Davar Gadol, right? Notice the Gadol Katan theme. Did he ask such a big thing? Now, of course, who can come up with such an idea? An Eved, who's used to maybe dealing with all of the bad stuff, and he can say, listen, he didn't ask for such a big thing. Try it, right? We've had to go. We're Avadim who once knew, maybe we knew freedom, right? And we've got taken down from our pedestal. We know what it is to experience humiliation, okay? It's not so bad to, there are worse things. He didn't ask you such a big thing. Halota said, do it. He told you, go bathe and you'll be purified. Try it. And then notice the phrase here. I think it's so interesting. It's true geographically. Shomron is up in the hills and the Yarden is way down low. But I don't think it's only geographical. Vayered, right? He has to go down. Vayitbol, he has to immerse himself in the Yarden. Even this word vayitbol strikes me as very interesting. The phrase in Torah for going to the mikveh is usually v'rachatz b'mayim, right? That's what it means. We nowadays use the word tvila, but that is not a word the Tanakh uses. Taval is usually to dip. In other words, I wonder whether he even went fully under the water, right? He was taval b'mayim. I don't know whether he put his leg in or went up to his waist or up to his chest. I'm not even sure he got, you know, he completely submerged himself. Whichever way, it says that vayitzbol b'yarden sheva pamim, he goes seven times, which is the instruction. Ki devar ish Elohim. Following the instruction of the Ish Elokim, and that was really hard for him. And now, Vayashu Basaro Kibsar Nar Katon Vayitar. He has, if you want, demeaned himself, right? He has vayered, and now he becomes this na'ar katon. The ish gadol has become this na'ar katon, which is amazing. And not only is his skin going to be returned to himself, but vayashav elish Elohim, he goes back to the man of God, hu v'chol machanehu, with his whole entourage. And now look at the language. Vayavo vayamod lefanav. Right, before it was just vayamod petach habayit, but now vayamod lefanav. He stands, what's lefanav?
Subservient,
exactly. Subservient to the man of God. He now realizes there is somebody over him, right? He has now understood that there is somebody who, you know, he is, you know, answerable to, subservient to. And he says, he assumes, since you solve me, what do I, am I going to give you? I'll give you a bracha, which really means a gift, right? I will give you, I brought a lot of money, clothing. I want to give you something, right? In order to pay you, because I owe you. To which, what does Elisha say? Chai Hashem, as God lives, asher amadati lefanav. In other words, you think you stand before me, but I stand before Hashem. The power is not invested in me. The power is invested in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In other words, the hierarchy goes higher. You think that the power is invested in me, the prophet, but my power is not my power. It's in God's power, right? And therefore, you can't give me a gift because Ki Lashem Amlucha, right? Hashem has the majesty. Hashem has the power, right? And therefore, there's no point in giving me a gift because it's not my power, right? Before, Naaman assumed that it was the power of the prophet, right? And that's why he wanted him to wave his hand and he thought he wouldn't do anything. But really, what Naaman's been taught this a lesson, right? It's not the prophet's power. In fact, here's the amazing irony that what does Hashem want us to do? Hashem wants us to make a change in ourselves. It's exactly what Rav Hirsch said before, right? It's not about some sort of magician doing something to on you and you standing petach habayit and not doing anything. You have to go into the Yarden. You have to change yourself. And this is where Judaism differs.
I want to back up a second. Why does Elisha take this on to begin with? And why does the text not say that he beseeched God's permission to do it?
Right. There is this mysterious thing with Elisha that Elisha frequently doesn't directly appeal to God. It's something which is a motif in almost all the stories of Elisha. He seems to do miracles, you know, just independently. And it's not exactly clear, you know, how to view Elisha in that regard. There are moments when he has to pray, when he has to revive the son and other situations. This just is Elisha's modus operandi. He more than not, you go to him and he works through a miracle. That's a whole nother topic that we can't deal with today. Elisha also seems to have, especially with Aram, he is actually eventually going to cause a power change within Aram. And he certainly seems to be interested in spreading God's name in the direction of Aram. That's all I can say. I don't know how to explain it much deeper than that. Yes, sorry. Right.
He was healed.
Right.
What is the purification?
Yeah, it's a good question. Although that's the phrase that's used all the time. That's what Elisha said, right? V'yashav basarcha l'cha v'tahar. I don't know whether it's indicating a sort of a deeper sense of cleansing inside, not just a medical healing, but like a deeper sense of cleansing of character or something like that. Yeah, last comment. Yeah. Right, okay.
Perhaps that's why it doesn't say every time you pray to God.
Maybe. Sorry, I see the time ticking away, so please excuse me. Let's just keep going. He Pasuk Tet Zayin, he begs him and says, Imekach, Vayisar bo lakachat, he set Vayima Ein, and he refuses. Okay? And now Naaman says, please give me two donkey loads of earth. They thought that God was imbued somehow in the land of Eretz Yisrael. It seems like he wants to make an altar, Mizbeach Adama. He wants to make an altar made of earth. And there I will serve a God. I won't serve to any other God. In other words, usually, maybe he would think that God is somewhere in the pantheon. God, he recognizes God, but now he recognizes God as the exclusive deity. Again, God being maybe the head of the pantheon, but the only God in the pantheon. I will not offer to any other God, Kiyim Lashem, except to Hashem. And very, very fascinating, he says, oh, please excuse me, because when my master bows down in this temple called Beit Rimon, he leans on me, right? So again, it seems to be a sort of reversal, a very interesting reversal of, you know, expression of hierarchy. He leans on me, so when I bow down, he's leaning on me. You know, I'm not really bowing down, please excuse me. You know, I have to support my master, but I have rejected the religious affiliation of my master. My only God from now is God. And off he goes, and he says, Lech l'shalom v'yelech miyato kivrat eretz. And this is where we're going to see, and the story could have ended here, but I want to pay attention to the last scene of the story in our last couple of minutes. And now what are we going to see about Gehazi, right? Gehazi is going to misunderstand all of this entirely. And what does he do? V'yoma Gehazi nar Elisha, verse 20, pasuk chaf, Ish Elokim, hinei chasach Adoni et Naaman Arami hazeh, mikachat miyado ad asher hevi. Two? Four?
Three.
Okay. He calls him ha'arami hazeh, this Aramean. He's like disdainful. And he says, he's denied him from taking all of this. And look how he talks. He's very disdainful, just the Aramean. Chai Hashem, ki imratzti acharav alakachti meito mumuma. That phrase, Chai Hashem, how was it used before? Before Elisha said, Chai Hashem imekach, as God lives, I will not take. Now he says, Chai Hashem, as God lives, we should take something from this Gentile, from this Aramean. We should get something out of this, right? We should make a little bit of money. And notice here, Pasuk Chafala, Vayirdof Gehazi Acharei Naaman. We've been talking a lot about Pesach. We know Vayirdof, Erdof, Asiga, Chalek, Shalal, right? He's got him as in his prey, in his sights. He wants to go and despoil him. And Naaman is totally the Baal Tshuva. Naaman sees him not Rodef Acharav, but Ratz Acharav. Vayipol me'al ha'merkava. He enthusiastically descends from the chariot and says, Hashalom, just like he was sent, right? Just like Elisha sent him in verse 19, Lech l'shalom. He assumes everything is Hashalom. You've come in order to greet me. And now, what does Gehazi do? He says, Shalom Adoni Shlachani. Of course, he's lying through his teeth. My master, he calls Elisha his master. Hine ataze boi elai shnei na'arim. Two boys came. Notice those na'arim, right? When na'arim are subservient to Elisha, of course, the na'ar being that his role, have come from Har Ephraim. And please give them one talent of silver and two changes of clothing. By the way, if there are two people and you want two changes of clothing, how many talents of silver would you expect? Two, right? He only asks for one. You see, Gehazi knows he's doing something wrong. Naaman gets the hint, by the way, and says, take two, take two. I'll simply say this, right? Notice how it says, verse 23, Vayomen Naaman, hoel kach kikraim, vayifratz bo. He begs him, vayatzar kikraim kesef. In other words, before what happened, it said, Vayiv tsar bo lakachat vayema'en. He begged him to take and he refused. Elisha refused. Now, of course, he begs him to take. And what does Gehazi do? He takes. The ultimate situation, since we do have to end, is now look in Pasuk Chafhei. Gehazi comes home, Vahuba vayamod. And what would you expect it to say? He comes back and he stands, Lifnei Adonav. But it doesn't say that. It won't use the word lifnei. Vayamod el Adonav. He is his master. However, is Gehazi subservient to him? No. Gehazi is working as an independent operator, and he is totally upending. He is totally turning upside down this entire construction that Elisha has constructed, which is such a powerful construction that it brings a Gentile senior army leader to a recognition of God. And now Gehazi threatens to completely reverse that by he sees the belief in God as simply a money machine. And of course, what does that mean? It is serving me. It is not serving God. All of the powers invested in Elisha are there to serve the human being, right? Not to serve Hashem. Hashem is not at the top of the totem pole. I am, right? And for this reason, because Gehazi puts himself first, right? What does Elisha say to him? Now the leprosy of Naaman will afflict you, because Gehazi has totally reversed the hierarchy. Here we see something quite fascinating that we frequently talk about tzaraat being connected to lashon hara, but it's not only lashon hara. As I put here in source number 2, they talk about it being on rucho gasa, the idea of pride or haughtiness. It's very interesting that tzaraat, which afflicts the body, the clothing, the body, the house, frequently these are the ways we make an image on other people. Our house, is it big or small? Is it well decorated or not? These, our clothes, are they elaborate or not? These are the ways that we make our image. The question with Lashon Hara, okay, is do I overstep my personal bounds into other people's bounds? Who does control me? Can I control myself? I can't wait to say this thing. It's like bursting out of me. And what this is encouraging us to understand is the appropriate hierarchy. We stand before Hashem, and we stand meekly before Hashem and realize that Hashem makes demands of us. And when we put ourselves first, then we are upending that vortex. We're upending the appropriate hierarchy, and the tzaraat Naaman affects us. Thank you very much. Chag Kasher v'Sameach to you all.